Welcome to Series 2 of the Big Beatles Sort Out. In the first series, I, author and musician Gary Abbott, ranked all the Beatles' core catalogue releases with the help of my Beatles expert brother Paul. In Series 2, we're looking at a selection of unreleased songs and alternative versions that appeared in the anthology, songs they wrote for other artists, and more. So join us as we continue to sort out the Beatles. Welcome to episode 49. Ooh, close to the big 50. And welcome to Paul I Want for Christmas Abbott.
Ah, merry me.
Merry you.
Merry me and a happy new me. Hello.
Hello. Before we crack on, don't forget you can follow us at big_sort on Twitter and Instagram or email us at bigbeatlesortout@gmail.com. And please like and share our post and tell everybody. And some of you have very kindly left us some reviews, I think, from a recent Twitter call out. If you're struggling to find a place on the internet to review us, because not all services have review functions, there's a place called Podchaser, which I think is more of an aggregate for all podcasts. So look us up on there if you can't find a review button on your app.
Yeah.
Yeah, that sounds about right, doesn't it, Paul?
Something like that. Or if you can't review or give us 5 stars or whatever, then a retweet is always useful if you get us on Twitter. But if not, then, you know, just enjoy it.
No
presh.
Yeah, absolutely. So how are you, Paul? And is there anything you've been up to that you'd like to tell people about?
It's an odd one because we're recording these in advance. But as of today, the day of recording, I have turned up on another podcast with my friend Ben Baker, who should be, he's like the third character in this podcast here, because I mentioned him quite a lot recently because I've been doing a lot of odds and sods with Ben. But people might know of Viz Comic. Certainly UK listeners will certainly know about Viz Comic. And Ben has done a pilot episode for a podcast called Hello, Good Evening and Swear Word. And I was the guest on the first one, looking at Viz Comic issue 1. Our friends listening abroad will probably not have heard of Viz. It is smutty, silly, adult comic, and it is brilliant. But it's I was his guest for his first episode of Hello, Good Evening and Swear Word beginning with B, and it was very nice to be asked to do it. And if you want to look that up, if you search for, well, look for Ben Baker Books and his links on Twitter, or look for the Don't Let's Chart podcast. It's been put on their podcast feed. If anyone wants to listen to me talking about smutty Northeast English cartoons from the 70s.
Sounds great. That's really good. Is he, so I know this is a pilot, but is the plan that he will continue through the whole catalogue? I mean, that's a lot of Viz, isn't it?
Yeah. It's given it's still running now and it started in 1979. I don't know what his plan is. I think it was select issues, as it were, or matters relating to.
Oh, well, I'll have to get him in touch with a friend of mine who's actually done a Viz comic strip.
Yes, you will. Yes, that would be good.
Rob Amos, who did Yeti Wainthrop Investigates, in which Hetty Wainthrop, being the British middle-aged lady detective, is just a Yeti.
That's the great thing about Viz. Although it is very smutty and there's lots of sexual jokes and rudeness, it is mainly just very strange, very silly things in the tradition of like the Beano and the Dandy, but like in a strange grown-up way. It's so
great stuff.
Yeti Wainthrop.
So, okay, I'm not going to bother you about my music. You know I'm a musician and you can find my stuff out there, Gary Abbott, with all the R's and all the B's and all the T's. So, let's go on this Beatles Day, which will be the 20th of December. So close.
So nearly to Christmases. Yes. Well, 20th of December, and I am taking us back to 1966 this time. And I chose this because, you know, it's funny with, like, Get Back being out now and there being a huge new amount of Beatles footage to enter the stuff that you see in your life. But for a long time, you just see the same sorts of bits of Beatles footage crop up over and over again. Certainly even if you were pre-YouTube and all that, you'd only have a handful of shows that you might have taped off TV or you've had on VHS or something like that. But one of the ones I always remember seeing is essentially It's the Beatles all individually walking into Abbey Road and being interviewed on the steps of Abbey Road. And that used to crop up all the time on various sort of histories and stories and stuff like that. And it was on this Beatles Day, 20th of December 1966, that those segments were done.
Okay.
So this is where they're being interviewed for ITN's Reporting 66 segment as they each go into sort of Abbey Road. It's actually an evening session they were going in to do more work on When I'm 64, which is like the first Pepper thing that they're working on, you know. And so it looks essentially like what Brian Epstein has done is said, look, everyone's just going on about the fact that you've split up on stuff like this, so that you're never going to work together again because John's been off doing the film and you stopped touring. So perhaps if you do these little interviews, that'll help put things to rest. So it's clearly be arranged for them to be doorstepped on the way into Abbey Road. So reporter's called John Edwards, and he sort of chats to all of them. He talks about what they're doing in the future, what are the rumours of the split, how is it making films, and, you know, what's touring like. And, you know, John is very personable and quite thoughtful. He sort of turns up with a bunch of albums under his arm walking in. He's very chatty. Paul is a bit sort of more ponderous and sort of about thinking about the future. You know, you can imagine exactly what he's like, you know.
Yeah.
And live performance and about how it's sort of not worth doing, given the circumstances they're playing in. Ringo is the last to be interviewed. He's sort of very pleasant. He talks about doing films, working together, and he's, you know, he's sort of talking to the camera, wishing everyone Merry Christmas, stuff like that. But the George bit, George is like as George ever gets. Like, he's just decided not to play ball at all.
Okay.
And so there's the little section with George is essentially, so he sort of, he turns up, I think, with Mal, and he's sort of coming in. You hear him just sort of saying, what is it? And John Edwards sort of goes, how are you? Can I just stop you? And George goes, well. And so John Edwards is trying to get him to say something. So there's like a little cut in it, which might be like saying, come on.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, John Edwards, so I want to ask you, do you think that in the new year you're going to be going your own ways instead of being in the group? Mm. And George just leans right onto the microphone and just goes, no. And then just starts walking off. And that's all, essentially.
Right.
And John Edwards shouts after him, no. And George just goes, no, definitely not. By this time, George is in the building. And John Edwards is like, what about another word? And then you just hear George as he's walking in just going, there aren't any more words. It's like all he wanted to say was no. He didn't want to say anything.
No, obviously not.
So clearly he was not in the mood for, you know, having to deal with this media interruption to his going into the session, even if it was arranged as it seems it actually was.
Yeah.
And then it ends up on TV on the 28th of December 1966. So, but yeah, it's such an interesting little rundown of their personalities at that time. But it's, like I say, it's one of those bits of footage you used to see all the time.
Mm.
And it's always interesting to know when and where these things actually happened.
Yeah, the images are popping into my memory, you know, from you having said it. I don't think I've seen it for a little while. Presumably it'll be amongst the full anthology DVD box set
I think it's on the anthology, yeah. I think bits of it are anyway. But yeah, it's because it's a good piece to illustrate that post-touring pre-Pepper thing where people didn't really know what was going on with them. Are they a spent force? Have they stopped working together? All that sort of stuff. So that's why it crops up a lot, you know.
Oh, cool. Okay. Well, that's a good one. Let's get on with the first song from the songs that the Beatles gave to other people to do, or however you want to phrase it. And first up this week, we have Like Dreamers Do by the Applejacks.
I saw a girl in my dreams, and so it seems that I will love her, oh you are that girl in my dreams.
Like dreamers do, Paul.
Well, yes, very dreamy dreams. Looking up to the sky, looking at clouds, thinking about things, stepping out into traffic, all that stuff. These are all Lennon McCartney numbers, obviously, as they have been so far. And all of the ones we're going to look at this week are primarily Paul generated songs.
Okay.
This is a very, very early Paul McCartney song, one of the very first songs he wrote, and they used to do it in the Cavern.
Right.
McCartney mentioned sort of we did a weak arrangement, but certain of the kids liked it because it was unique. None of the other groups did it. That's what he said about it. And
a weak arrangement.
Yeah.
Like, you didn't think it was a very strong song.
But it's got a really important thing. Before we get onto the Applejacks, we do need to mention, there is a Beatles version of this. People will know quite well that this is on Anthology 1 as part of the Decca audition. Mm. But it's quite an important song in the Beatles' early catalogue and their attempts to get a record deal, because it's one of the ones that, after the Decca audition comes and goes, it's one of the ones that Brian's showing off as like, this is my band, and this is them. They've written this, alongside a couple of other originals from that session. And this is one of the ones that, when it gets to sort of talk to some publishers at Ardmore and Beechwood, which is EMI's publishing arm, they're sort of like, well, do you know what? We're not so interested in the band, but we quite like a songwriting team because that means royalties for us. And so they're quite... So Like Dreamers Do is sort of significantly like the thing that they're sort of saying, well, do you know what? If we sign the band, they can put out a version of this, but then we'll have the song because we'll have signed it to Ardmore and Beechwood publishing. So it's, if you read Lewison's book about this, it kind of is like, well, they were never going to take the Beatles until they realised that they could try and get the publishing stuff for this original material, potential hits with these things. And so they sort of push the Beatles onto George Martin, who kind of didn't necessarily want them.
Mm.
But of course, that's all a narrative that's quite dense and twisted, and sort of new material came out with Lewison's book. And it's all a bit contradictory of the myth about how George Martin ultimately said this, that, and the other, but this is one of the songs that symbolizes that. It's sort of the song that symbolizes, like, well, we want that.
Okay.
But it's the ironic thing, of course, is that they do sign the Beatles and they don't do Like Dreamers Do themselves.
No.
And it ends up in the Northern Songs catalogue.
And so is it just plucked out by the Applejacks some years later then? When did they do it, did you say?
Well, they offered it to them. So John and Paul offered it to them. So the Applejacks.
Yes.
Okay. So we know this exists. Beatles played it plenty of times, did it in the auditions, stuck it in the back pocket, forgot about it a little bit. I don't know the date that this was recorded on. Music direction was Mike Leander. Production was Mike Smith, who oversaw the Beatles Decca audition, ironically.
Okay.
And this comes out on Decca on the 5th of June, 1964. And the B-side of the Applejacks Like Dreamers Do is a song called Boom, 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 Everybody Fall Down.
Right.
Which is, I've not listened to, because I just find the title much more amusing. I don't really want to ruin the fun of the title.
It sounds like it could either be something written by the Venger Boys or by Baldrick.
Or both together. Finally. But yeah, Like Dreamers Do spends 11 weeks on the chart. It peaks at number 20, so it's not a top 10 smash hit, but, you know, not bad.
Mm.
And the Applejacks are a group from Solihull, so sort of a group that they were labelled, like Merseybeat was used, they were labelled as Brumbeat.
Okay.
So, because they're from the Midlands. Yeah. So it was a group of friends who were all like scouts and guides, who'd had a sort of instrumental skiffle group, and then they add a singer to that.
Okay.
And they get signed to Decca. So it's a group of mainly fellas, but the bass player, Megan Davies, is a girl, which is sort of fairly unique at the time. Mm. You know, there was them and there was like the Honeycombs, who had a female drummer. So that's something that makes them stand out, the Applejacks here. They had a hit with a song called Tell Me When, and then they meet the Beatles during a rehearsal for one of the television shows that they were both doing.
Mm.
It was apparently Thank Your Lucky Stars, although I couldn't find evidence that they were on an episode together, so I don't know whether they did mixed rehearsals for different shows or whatever.
Yeah.
But apparently after that meeting, John and Paul offer them this song.
Okay.
But the Applejacks' career in terms of hits sort of peters out very quickly. After this comes out as a single, they have one more single in the charts. And then Decca sort of says to them, can you put out, your next single's going to be Chim Chimmery.
Right.
You know, or Chim Chimchery, however you pronounce it. Chim Chimchery.
Yeah.
Which is a fine song from a fine film. And obviously Mary Poppins was a huge mega smash.
Yeah.
But they were like, no.
Mm.
And they go off and sort of do cabaret on cruise ships and things like that, and sort of just disappear out of the spotlight for the music scene.
Okay.
So, yeah. You have Al Jackson on lead vocal, Martin Baggett on lead guitar / vocal, Phil Cash on rhythm guitar and vocal, Megan Davies bass and vocal. She's now Megan Brady. Gerald Freeman, who's a drummer who married Megan Davies in the 60s. in a sort of showbiz wedding thing. You can see some like news footage of that. And Don Gould on piano and organ and vocal and stuff like that. And yeah, so they do this version of this Beatles song.
Great. And the Applejacks, everybody, the Applejacks. Yeah. Yes. So, well, it's a nice chirpy start to the music of this one, of, to the episode and to this song. I do
They've switched from the Beatles version, haven't they? The Beatles version starts with that bum, 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 bum. And they get this very, very perky piano.
Din, 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 din. Yeah, it's nice and bouncy and puts you on in a mood straight away. And I like how it bounces off the vocal in the verses. It keeps the verses interesting as well. The verses have a McCartney circularity, but that riff stops it from being too repetitive. I think that piano thing, which is that presumably came out of their own arrangement of it, because it, like, it's not definitely really in the Beatles thing, and it's actually a hook of its own, isn't it? It's a good addition to the song.
Yeah, it's they found a riff, and it, but rather it be a guitar part, it's a funny little sort of bright piano part, which is sort of gives it a sort of cutesy 60s charm that a lot of these other arrangements don't necessarily have.
Absolutely,
it's sort of goofy, but also quite appealing.
Yeah. And then into the chorus. I like how the chorus starts off. It tails off a little bit, but it falls nicely back into the vocal. It's not as strong as the verses, really, but it unbalances the song a little towards the kind of the verses. But it's got some interesting bit. And then it's got an outro, which I would have thought before I heard the Beatles version that was them doing that thing of, you know, this is a song by McCartney, you know, Lennon McCartney, everybody, please buy it, because it sounds like a Twist and Shout ending. But actually, listening to the Beatles version, that's actually in there as well.
So yeah. So although they've excised it from the opening of the song, they have stuck
they've
to
kept it on it. Yeah, yeah.
Which yeah, is, the Beatles dun 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 ending.
But it's very dun, almost dun, just dun 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 dun, dun, ch, ch, dun almost. You know, it's kind of
not far off, is it?
But it's actually it's not them just kind of saying trying to hint at the its provenance. It's just that's what it was. It's a very passable little song with a nice riff and verses, bit of a weak chorus and main line. The it's not the Like Dreamers Do hook that you come away remembering. It's the da-da-da-da-da, which is the immediate hook. So weird that, because that's not actually the McCartney-Lennon bit, really. I think the general playing and everything is pretty on point, and I can't complain about it.
Backing vocals are quite good. Yeah. You know, it's pretty snappy and tight as a performance. Really, well, it's quite, in fact, it's a really solid performance. Yeah. I think.
The vocals get a bit soupy in the louder second half of the choruses, but I think that's the production.
Yeah.
But it's in the world of ditty, I think. So I'm going to give it 55 for music, because it's not bad, but it's not like, I don't think it's meant to be anything progressive or even amazing. It's a okay, nice ditty. It's a ditty. Mm. So yeah, 55 for music. Onto production, then. There isn't much to say other than that. Do you see what I mean about the voices? I think there's a bit...
Yeah, that's my note. Big vocal reverb, really big vocal reverb.
Yeah, and it's just in the second half of the choruses, they kind of, which implies that they felt that needed something. So they're pushing those sliders up, or whatever it was at the time, turning those dials, winding up the reverb monster, whatever it is.
Yeah.
To make it all start going, but it gets really heavy and on the lead vocal. So when the backing joins in, it gets just a wash and gets lost. But I do like that piano sound. It's got that. Do you think it's that kind of? Is it, what's it called? I want to call it tacky piano. Well,
tack piano. Tack piano. Yeah. I don't know actually whether they've done anything. To make it bright. But yeah, it's either they've recorded it and then EQ'd it to be really bright, or they might have even done a little. Put the tacks into the hammers to give it a sort of proper pinging sound, maybe. Yeah. But otherwise, it is totally sort of down the line, early mid-60s pop production. Nothing wrong with it at all. I think the drums are quite nicely recorded and played, but the bass is not only recorded really well and comes across really, really good on the recording, but it's also really well performed, because it is just a dum, da dum, da dum. But to get that really tight sound... I think Megan Davies does an amazing job on that, and the fact that it's then recorded well and balanced well in the mix as well, it's a really good performance.
Yeah, yeah, well done, Megan. It does sound good, and it's captured well. I'm going to give it a good averagey 56 for production. onto the lyrics then. I mean, these are smaltzy, but they're consistently smaltzy. There's no birds and trees in this one. Just the dream girl motif that we're familiar with. You know, it's nothing new, such as, I guess by the time, I don't know because I'm not good with the dates, but things like Dream Lover would have existed by the time he was writing this, wouldn't he?
It's a trope.
It's a trope, a favourite of mine, Dream Lover. And other such songs featuring dreamy dreamers and dreaming and dreams, such as Dream. What's that one? Dream.
That's you saying the word dream.
Dream, dream, dream. I mean, that's just a song where the word is just dream, just the word dream. Yeah. So it's dream. It's a standard and it works for this, for what it is. So I'm going to give it 49 for lyrics.
Yeah, it's funny because it's got a... McCartney's sort of doing it on the Decca audition, what we'll get to in a second, gives it a sort of a bit of a throwbacky quality. And it's got a bit of that in that... the way the words come out in like the repeated syllables of like I and waiting for you, all that sort of stuff.
Yeah.
Which is part of the lyrics rather than just saying it and I.
Yeah.
It actually the lyrics are and I. Yeah.
Do 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 do. Yeah, it's that. Yeah, it's definitely of a style doing that kind of thing, isn't it? Of a time, of a feel and genre. I think that suits it. It works well. So, as I said, 49 for lyrics, which gives it 53.3 overall.
Oh, I think it should have had more than that.
Well, it didn't, but...
curse your system.
Yeah.
Curse your whims.
I still think that's not so bad in the scheme of things compared to some of the ones. Going on to the Beatles version then, just to have a quick chat about that. Let's have a little listen to it first.
I saw a girl in my dreams, and so it seems that I will love her. Oh, you are that girl in my dreams.
So yeah, it's a very different feel to this, isn't it? It's different tempo and swing to it altogether, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, you have to remember as well, this is the Decca audition and it's not the Beatles playing their best.
Yeah, so what I wanted to ask you about this, because I noticed you mentioned this a couple of weeks ago and you said about, there's kind of the Decca audition's about it. Why then? And it isn't great, you know, it's not recorded great and they are a bit, what was going on? Why are they?
Well, I mean, it's New Year's Day for a kickoff. They've driven down from Liverpool in absolutely atrocious weather. It's freezing cold.
Right.
They've been out the night before.
Because they've been to New Year's Eve.
Yeah. Mm. And they're in London, yeah. So, but, you know, they've had a strange experience. They're not necessarily made the most comfortable when they get in there. They're nervous as much as anything. You know, they get studio nerves. Mm. You know, the red light comes on, red light syndrome, freaks them out. So it sort of... does for Paul's voice a little bit, so he's not as good as he could be.
Yeah.
Pete doesn't play well. Mm. But still, you know, it's an interesting thing, but it does sound like they're playing a throwback song rather than Here Comes the Beatles type thing. It's like, well...
Yeah.
There goes the 50s.
Well, that's it. Whereas the Applejacks managed to make it not sound like a throwback.
Yeah, they make it sort of contemporary to, you know, 1964.
It's not the greatest, the Beatles version. But, you know, obviously got the idea across and enough to, like you said, possibly be one of the catalysts to their whole signing.
Yeah, it's important enough to push them forward, you know, despite what I just said. Actually, clearly the publishers heard something in it and had some idea that this could be a thing.
That's good. Okay, well, let's go on to our next one. From a Window. Billy J. Kramer with the Dakotas.
Oh, I would be glad just to have a love like that. Oh, I would be true, and I'd live my life for you. So, meet me tonight, just where the light shines from a window.
From a window, Paul.
From a window, you can see all sorts of things like trees and houses and cars and roads and people. Well, I can anyway from my windows.
Well done.
What about your windows? Write and tell us. From a Window. So Billy J. Kramer with the Dakotas. We
know all about familiar them. With,
we know all about them now because they're good pals to this situation. Anyway, this is recorded on the 29th of May, 1964. George Martin in production mode here. Released on the 17th of July, 1964. It's charts for 8 weeks and peaks at number 10. There's no Beatles version to speak of for this.
No.
Although we know that John and Paul were in attendance at the session where Billy J recorded this.
Okay.
And there's a version, if anyone wants to look up another weird version of this, there's a version by a duo called Chad and Jeremy.
Right.
In 1965, so a year after this, which has the most insane guitar solo in the middle of it, like a sort of acoustic guitar solo, but it's much more weird and forward in the mix and just so strange. So I would encourage everyone to go and listen to Chad and Jeremy's version as well, but we're not covering that because it's his Billy J that they've given it to. And yeah, it's it's another song from Paul that he's given to Billy J. It's it's interesting, this one. This is one of the ones I've always been least familiar with.
Okay. I mean, I don't think I'd heard it until this, or maybe no, I hadn't. No, although now I feel like I have, because it's one of those songs that worked for me, goes really, kind of just instantly installs itself in my brain without any worries. It's got a really nice feel, this one. I like that tempo that it's at, the bass root note keeping it kind of grounded with
it's got a bit of a Ticket to Ride feel,
hasn't it? Got
Pre Ticket to Ride, it's got that
What's that musical term for that kind of feel? It's almost like a half beat feel, kind of,
Yeah, I know. So yeah,
got a lazy lilt to it, hasn't it? And it's
So you've got, when you've got a tempo, it's like 1, 2, 3, 4, 1, but you're emphasizing dum 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 dum. So you're putting the weight all at one part of the bar, rather than having a sort of consistent rhythm pattern across the bar.
Absolutely. It's like a nice, I like it, and it makes the chord changes when they come all the more impactful, because they've kind of had this kind of, they hold it on this one kind of chord with this root bass note, the doom doom, and when it does move, it's like and then it kind of sighs into it. It's great. And just under 2 minutes.
It's short.
It's short. It makes you wonder, actually, because really it's a slow song, if it could have had a, if it's missing a section, that's the only thing. I wonder if it's a bit shorter than it could have been. They could have found something else just to give it a bit.
Well, it's not so short compared to other things that were around at the time. It's
I guess it's short but slow as well. So that's a strange combo.
Yeah, maybe that's it.
It's weird how it doesn't. But then I suppose if it does everything it needs to do, sometimes with these songs they're so prolific, aren't they, that you feel like they go, here's the meat. The meat of the song is done here. That's why some of their songs were only 1 minute 45 or whatever, because they're like, the song has done everything that we have, the nugget that we have kind of come up with for this song done. What else are you going to do? Just listen to it. Just listen to the song again if you like it.
Yeah,
I suppose. I guess it was in the days before 3.5 minutes start to become a standard. And I like it. Billy sings it nicely. The band play it well. There's a bit of doubling issues, a little bit again, but nothing inexcusable or that would be out of place for even the boys themselves. A couple of lines.
No, not particularly. I mean, we've talked about Billy's voice and his need for to be double tracked. Apparently, the last note at the end.
Yeah, that's a bit of a funny one.
It's a bit wobbly, but apparently McCartney's harmonising on that last note, according to some sources.
If something sounds strange. He's singing it in a way like you almost can imagine him having to be vocal coached to sing it. It doesn't sound so, maybe because he can almost hear him going like, I'm gonna. It's a bit like Ringo before his little help from my friends outro.
Yeah,
like
it's like, come on, lad,
you can do it. You can do it. So it doesn't suit him well. And I said, actually, my note is I think one of his doubled vocals goes up and the other stays put, and it's a bit unconfident. That's probably him underneath McCartney then, if it is McCartney. Not sounding as locked in as he would be, But I think the solo is nice and tight in this. There's a good guitar solo, isn't there?
There is a good guitar solo in this.
Yeah.
And the other thing that's I suppose it's sort of treading into production as well, is there's piano throughout as well.
Yeah.
Doing a lot of George Martining.
George Martining, by what do you mean?
In the sense of he liked to add piano to things. And so he's doubling up the bass parts on the piano and he's playing a sort of, well, whoever's playing is playing sort of throughout the middle sections, and it gets a bit swampy in the reverb.
Oh, okay. Well, I'll just give the music score so we can move on to the swampy reverb. So I'm going to give it 59 for music. I didn't have much to say about production, even me and my reverb radar. I thought it was pretty good other than the outro note. I just quite liked it.
I think it's good. I do quite like it, but I think the piano becomes a bit washy because of the reverb they've put on it.
Hmm.
Which is, it's interesting. It's George Martin loves putting the extra piano on stuff, so it probably is him playing it. I don't know, but it probably is him playing it. I like the way it doubles the bass. That gives it extra weight.
Yeah, it does,
especially given the dum, you know, how important that low end is in there. But yeah, it sort of gets a little bit murky, I think. But but it's, you know, it's very George Martin doing what George Martin did.
It slipped past my murkiness detector, and I'm giving it 65 for production. Because I think it's a nice, neat delivery of the song. I think it's quite well. It's quite well. It's quite good even. So, lyrics then. So I find the interesting thing with these lyrics is they're kind of similar to No Reply.
That's exactly what I have on my note here.
Because they're seeing a light from the window. But in this one, he's caught a glimpse of her and fallen in love. Whereas in No Reply, she's actively trying to avoid him. And he's saying, but I saw you. Yeah. I knew you were in.
Your face.
Your face. And it has your face in it again. Not your face. It doesn't have your face in it, Paul. It has your face in it.
Oh, my God. It's like something out of The Prisoner.
Yeah, but it has the line, something about your face in it again, doesn't it? Which makes me think they have a common source.
Oh, yes, your face came into sight,
Well,
that's what I thought. That's exactly what I thought as well. So No Reply turns up on Beatles for Sale.
Yeah.
I don't know, No Reply was another song they tried to give away ended up doing themselves. So I do think they've probably got very, very similar origins.
Okay, what were the dates kind of? What forensic?
Well, this comes out July 64, and Beatles for Sale, the album anyway, comes out in December 64.
Oh, it could just be resonating in their head.
It's of the style of the period.
Yeah, the light from the window. It's a nice phrase, from a window. In this, it just, you wouldn't think it would make a good phrase for a song, but the way it's delivered and sung, and how soft it's sung, and it actually makes it what could be quite a mundane line quite poetic. But I think they're clear and effective lyrics. I'm going to give them 50. Which, you know,
a lot of the rest of it, other than the window idea, is a bit like, you know, I had to make you mine, I knew you were the one, which is very by the book, isn't it?
By the numbers. So yeah, that's why I've given it right down the middle. So 50, which gives it overall a 58.
Mm-hmm.
So as you said, there is no Beatles version to listen to. So we go straight on to our next one, which is It's For You, Cilla Black.
Hello, this is John Lennon of the Beatles. We'd like to play you a song now that Paul and I have just written, especially for Cilla Black. A beautiful girl, a beautiful singer. Hope you like it. Here it is. It's called It's For You.
I'd say someday I'm bound to give my heart away when I do. It's for you.
It's for you, Paul.
Oh, thank you. It's Christmas time. Yeah, It's For You by Cilla Black, as you say. This comes out on the it's recorded on the 2nd of July 1964. John and Paul are in attendance again, we know that.
Mm-hmm.
It's recorded by George Martin with the accompaniment directed by George Martin. He gets a credit on the disc for that. And it comes out on the 31st of July, 1964, spends 10 weeks in the charts and peaks at number 7. Ooh. So it's a big hit.
I thought it would get a bit higher than that. But well, I mean, it's 10 weeks at number 7 is great. It's a top 10, but I thought it might have gone further.
Well, this is Cilla Black's fourth single.
Okay.
So her first one was Love of the Loved, which we covered before.
Yeah.
Her second single was Anyone Who Had a Heart, her version of it, which got to number 1. And the third single was You're My World, which also got to number 1. So this is a step down from what she'd been doing.
Mm-hmm.
But I think tellingly, although apparently Cilla didn't think so, I think this is like they, Paul particularly, who wrote this, has listened to Anyone Who Had a Heart and especially that one, and You're My World, and gone, oh, right, so that's how Cilla songs go.
Right.
I'll write a song for Cilla that goes like that, because this is a waltz.
Yeah.
It's not a Beatles beat piece.
No, no.
So.
Well, we'll get into that.
Yeah.
Well, like, we'll get into it now, unless you've got anything else in the Cilla Black Bank we need to talk about, because we Cilla's already appeared, like you said, so.
Yes.
We have covered.
I'll just say, so one of our Twitter followers and listeners, Gillian Riley, is a big fan of Cilla.
Okay.
And I've been chatting to her on our little Twitter feed, which a big underscore sort on Twitter. I might have more to say about her vocal style in this one that might not be quite so positive. Sorry, Gillian.
Yes, let me apologise in advance, Gillian, for my brother's insensitive. No, it's fine. Yes, hello, Gillian. We'll get onto it then, and we'll see what it is you don't like. So, musically then, is it usual? First thing I have to check, before anything, is I've listened to the remastered version of it when I was doing my notes and everything, and they have the John Lennon intro.
They've got that weird... Yeah, so the remastered version that you can find on Spotify, obviously this wasn't on the original recording on the disc.
No.
But it's clearly a radio announcement by John saying, hello, this is John Lennon of the Beatles. We'd like to play you a song now that Paul and I have just written, specially for Cilla Black. Beautiful girl, beautiful singer. Hope you like it. Here it is. It's called It's For You, but in John's voice.
Yeah.
And, yeah, it's funny that they've stuck that on the front of the... I think it was a 2003 remastering, wasn't it? So clearly it was just done as a sort of legacy thing.
Yeah.
Which is actually a shame, because it would be nice to hear that, but it not to be over the music.
If
you try to listen to the song, which it is. Fortunately, you can find a clean version elsewhere.
It's just an interesting thing. I did wonder if it was tagged on in the remaster. I did think it would be a bit strange and a bit too on the nose to kind of literally have a Beatle saying, we wrote this at the beginning of the song. But yeah, so again, we have the boys giving Cilla a song that this, I think, is similar. Although you're saying Paul McCartney has had the kind of feedback, the Cilla feedback loop, in order to engineer this song to her. I a bit like Love of the Loved, it plays to a dramatic delivery. I think they'd done that previously, but this was a bit more Shirley Bassey-esque type of thing, if you know what I mean. Kind of chromatic, Spanish-y, James Bondy cadences that feel very charged. I don't know how to explain it, but it's got a drama to it
it definitely does, and they've definitely written it for that to be dramatic. It's got this sort of minor key waltz descending bass line pattern thing going on, and it's very jazzy.
It is very jazzy, but it's showy as well, and big and filmy and all those kind of words that make you, it's hard to put your finger on, but it's and I think Love of the Loved was a bit like that, but I think this is more, for me, I think this is more refined for her than that was. I like how it's very jazzy in places, and I wonder how much of that is the interpretation of the band and the score that Martin presumably came up with because it's got a great swing feel, and then in those B sections with the kind of like da 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 da, you know, that very
There's some mad jazz drums going on in those sections.
Big showy staccato melody with the band joining on the hits and everything. It's a great piece being played really well by this, I presume, as studio musicians, basically. And Cilla, I think, doing a great job of hitting those loud, brash notes and then falling right back down to a small, soft voice when it needs to. Lots of range. I think it's a really good bit of music. I really like it.
Yeah. Well, like you say, you know, Love of the Loved was a Beatles song that Cilla did. This is a song the Beatles wrote for Cilla.
Yeah.
You know, Paul wrote. So it meets your requirements as you stated them there.
Yeah.
And I think what's interesting is and this sort of goes between music and production, is Cilla recalled that it was a session where John was there, Paul was there, and obviously George Martin's there directing the band and all that stuff and overseeing the session. And so, but basically everyone was putting in suggestions of how it should go.
Okay.
So they'll have had all this sheet music written out and for the musicians and things like that. But then obviously they're going in and John and Paul are giving suggestions about, well, why don't you try it like this, Syl? Or why don't you try it like this? And George saying, well, why don't you try it like this? And obviously then if there's things with the musicians having to adjust things and change things and stuff. And so apparently it was a bit of a session where they were all sort of like, you know, all four of them, John, Paul, George and Syl, are all adding their own suggestions and sort of doing this bizarre session to come up with this.
That's amazing that this came out of that, because this feels very coherent and not at all
written by committee. Yeah, it does, yeah. We managed to get something. I suspect at the end of the day what it comes down to George Martin overseeing the session.
Yeah,
having a bunch of studio musicians he's got to pay and make sure they know what they're playing.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I'm going to give it a big 80 for music.
Wowzers!
Yeah. I was really impressed, and I don't think I'd heard it before, and I thought, you know, it's just a great bit of music.
Yeah. Well, before we get on to production, then, I better address the Scylla voice thing.
Okay, go on then, yeah.
So I mentioned when we talked about Love of the Loved is that a reason I quite like Scylla's Love of the Loved is because it uses the voice of hers that I like. So she has this thing where she suddenly, when she has to put extra volume in her voice, her voice, the tonality, the timbre, the texture of her voice changes.
Yeah.
And that sort of becomes the voice that she sort of got the Mickey taken out of her for in later years. Surprise, surprise.
Yeah.
That wasn't a very good impression. It's sort of...
she sounded more like she was from Yorkshire in that one, didn't it?
Yeah, it's a surprise for you coming in the coal house. I don't know what I'm talking about. But you'll hear in this, when she goes to do the louder sections, that the quality of her voice changes. Yeah. Now, it's fine. It's fine. She's singing in tune. She's singing very well. She's very in control of her voice. I'm not a massive fan of that louder voice of Scylla's, which is, so it's always a relief in this when it comes back down again to that sort of, you know, the verse, the voice she uses in the verses.
Yeah. But this song demands it, really. It didn't bother me, but I can see what you mean. Yeah. But it didn't bother.
But it's a good illustration of the way Scylla's voice isn't simple. Essentially, it's quite a complicated voice.
Yeah, which is good. She has got some range.
Yeah, she's got the tools.
Yeah. Okay. Well, your objection is duly noted. On to production then. I think this one is going to score really well because I think the production-wise, we have a really tight, big band kind of sound going on. But it's actually a cut above the other songs we've been covering for the quality. I think it's because of the. I think this is the same with the music. It's a very musical song. There's a lot of music in it. I know that sounds daft, but rock and pop is very, by its nature, repetitive in places, and that's why. There's always more to get stuck into with later.
Yeah, this isn't beat music.
No,
this is. Big ballad, big band.
Yeah, this is the kind of production that's more like mid to late era Beatles stuff. When you know, because it's got accompaniment and strings and double bass and stuff like that. I mean, is it talking about that? The piano sounds great, and is it doubling with a double bass? I'm sure there is a bass piano note and a double.
It wouldn't surprise me. It's George Martin.
Yeah, because occasionally I thought, oh, you know what? They're just doing the bass all on the piano notes, really nicely mic'd up. But then occasionally...
Yeah, no, I think it is. I think it is the bass and the piano.
Yeah, then you hear a slide. You think, well, that can't be a piano. So it must be... Yeah. There must be a... But they're playing in unison. It's really nicely captured. The strings are great too. Soft, but very present in the mix. They've got that... He's got that great... I mean, it's George Martin, isn't it? So he's doing a really good job of this, I think.
Yeah, it's George Martin. He's with a Lennon McCartney song, a good female singer, a good band, his own arrangement in EMI... You know, Abbey Road, with his engineers.
Yeah, he's in his comfort place here. It's not just his comfort place, actually. His happy place, I'd say.
He's got an artist who's had, you know, three hit singles, two number ones. It's not a rush in, a rush out job as well at this point. So it's not like, oh, just get Scylla's thing done and get it off. It's, you know, he knows he's got to do a good job here because it's, you want to carry on this winning streak for Parlophone.
Yeah, absolutely. So I'm going to give it a big old 80 for production as well. because I think it's...
Blimey, I just honestly wouldn't have thought a Scylla song was going to come out.
Well, no, you did
come out this high.
You know, I never knew, you never know, do you? Till I mean, obviously this is me, so I mean, maybe I'm a secret Scylla fan, I didn't know it, but I suppose, you know, Love of the Love didn't score like this. I think it's this song, I think it's touched.
Yeah, but I think Scylla is good, and perhaps some of her other 60s stuff is very undiscovered, and it's worth listening to, because you tend to only know the big singles, because... You know, that's how history treats people who aren't the Beatles or the Who or the Rolling Stones.
Yeah, and it's also a bit of a change of pace, isn't it? And as much as I am very much enjoying all of these, obviously there's a bit of a core of, there's a bit of a slush pileness about some of it because of the nature of it. And so when some of these gems really do shine, when you think, oh, they could afford to give that away. But actually, because as being the songwriters they were, it wouldn't have been something that... Well, we'll hear a Beatles version of it, but yeah, anyway, it's good. So the only thing that brings us back to earth a little bit is the lyrics. I don't think you can have everything. I think because the music's so good, these lyrics are sufficient because they just give us something to sing, you know, over this great song. But again, a bit like Love of the Loved, we have a melodramatic song with a not very melodramatic content. There's not a lot of meat.
Well, I don't know. I mean, they said that love was a lie. I mean, that's a repeated line that's in loads of songs as well.
But if they...
I don't know. I think they suit it. And I like the fact that in the second sections, sort of the quicker... Where she has to do the quicker voice bits.
Yeah.
Those are interesting, the way those lyrics have to sort of...
Yeah, no, I like that bit. I've got that. It sounds very quick and verbally dexterous, but the words are quite basic. So they said, love was a lie, told me that I should never try to find somebody who'd be kind. But actually, if you put those words on a page... Next to it,
that's the section that's got the best line in it. It's just, so I just tell them they're right. Who wants a fight?
Who wants a fight?
When you read it written down rather than listening to it, rather, because it's supposed to be like, you know, who wants a fight? No, I don't want to fight. Nobody wants to fight about this. When you read it written down, it's like, who wants a fight? Come on.
Question mark. Yeah, like, you know, it's Scrappy Scouser, though.
Oh, yeah. I'm Scotty Rold.
So, yeah, I think the delivery elevates them beyond what they look like on the page. But all the rhyming that is needed is in the right places. What I mean is that it could have been... it could possibly have made this a really big classic if, again, like Love of the Loved, if it had just got some more narrative within the lyrics because of the nature of the song. It feels like if they'd have been more poetic with it, I don't know. It feels like there was much more room for, but it does what it needs to do. But they're not groundbreaking. If you read them off the page, you wouldn't be particularly.
It feels reverse engineered from the title again, which we've talked about before.
Yeah. So I'm giving 47 for lyrics, which brings its overall down to 69.
That's not bad.
It's not bad at all. The Beatles version, then, we have a very brief, kind of 20 odd second demo of this that you'll be able to find on YouTube. And if I've been a good boy, we'll be linked in the episode description. But if not, go to YouTube and look for demo for this. And it's Paul singing the main verse, really. A little bit of it, isn't it?
Yeah.
I'd say someday I'm bound to give my heart away. If I do, it's for you.
You can't glean much from this other than a guide, really, I'd say. It's hard to hear.
The version that we can hear that you can find on YouTube, I'm not entirely sure that that's the full, because apparently there is an acetate demo of it somewhere, which must be a longer version, I'm sure. But that rather than this 29 seconds sketch that he's
done. Well, it just
cuts
off as well, doesn't it? So it does feel like this is a snippet. Yeah. Like maybe someone's managed to keep it under lock and key for a bit.
I think when Scylla's stuff was auctioned off after she died, you know, the existence of the acetate version of this, McCartney's version. We know that it exists, but I don't think it's ever leaked.
Oh, yeah.
So we just have this little oddity, this 29 seconds of...
Yeah. You just get an idea for it, don't you? But there's no real way of hearing how that was going to turn into this other than it's the chords and the melody. That's it. So,
although, interestingly, on that little demo version, he doesn't include the words "It's for you" after the first pass of lyrics. He does a sort of like holds off the hook So I'd say someday I'm bound to give my heart away when I do. And then he's, rather than him singing It's For You there, he sort of holds it off. He doesn't put it in. Mm. Then he does the next thing and puts the It's For You at the end of it, which Cilla doesn't do. And I don't know whether that was just...
It's probably just
him trying it out or a mistake on his part, yeah. But it was interesting. It could have been, delayed gratification for the song title by not including it straight away.
Yeah. Well, anyway, let's go on to the next one then. I Don't Want to See You Again, Peter and Gordon.
Why do I cry at night? Something wrong could be right. I hear you say to me, I don't want to see you again. As you turned your back on me, you hit the light.
I don't want to see you again, Paul.
Well, this is made my Christmas take a turn for the worse.
Yes, it's a real shame.
I'm coming down to visit. Yeah, this is another one I'm relatively unfamiliar with. Again, Paul essentially being the progenitor of this one because it's Peter and Gordon. So we've talked about who they were. I don't know the date that this is recorded. It's recorded for Columbia, so it's under presumably Norman Newell again in Abbey Road. Comes out on the 9th of September 1964. And it doesn't chart in the UK, but it does get to number 16 in America.
Oh, that's interesting.
Which tells you something about the market for these sorts of things.
Yeah.
That whatever it was that Peter and Gordon were doing was not necessarily working as well here as it was in America.
Yeah.
Because they did very well in America with these first few songs. And you'll remember as well that when I talked about them previously, I talked about a news article where they said, yeah, we're not going to do any more Lennon McCartney things.
Yes.
Well, this is the third single that the band put out, and it's the third Lennon McCartney song in a row. So
I want to jump ahead in the Peter and Gordon story. Did they ever write their own stuff? Did they do that?
Yeah, they did. Yeah. Ever put anything? Some of the flip sides of these discs are songs that they wrote.
Do you think they were good in popular in America because they are? Was Simon and Garfunkel around at this point? They would have been, wouldn't they? So
no, not really. Yeah. No,
okay.
No.
I just there was the kind.
I know what you mean. I know what you're thinking about.
There's a bit
about,
of a folksy scene going on, isn't there? Still in America, in the village and things.
Well, yeah. There's got to be a reason.
Okay.
It's just an oddity. It's a bit of an oddity. An oddity that lined people's pockets when they were getting. If something hits number 16 in America, and that makes it a hit.
Oh yeah.
But it doesn't chart in the UK. That is really interesting about the markets.
It's strange. Yeah, so yeah, we have Pete and Gordo again, my mates.
Pete and Gordo.
It's one of those ones. I'm still not sure what I'm making of this yet. Having had never heard it before. So it's a pleasant enough melody, but it feels a bit basic again. A bit like one of the other ones we had recently, Peter and Gordon's, that wasn't one of the better ones. A bit modal. This has to resolve to this. You know, it has to, kind of a bit middle of the road, a little too easy listening. I prefer the B section actually to the it's the more interesting section and gets
yeah,
going.
Yeah, no, I agree with you. The sort of slightly different tempo.
Yeah, it's got a bit more like, hey, now we're getting somewhere. But then it has to go back to the
Yeah.
But then when the strings join in the verses, it gives them a bit more weight and gravitas and starts to get going as well. So
yep.
I start to like it a bit more. Especially with the peculiar... Okay, this is my guess.
Go for it.
Muted clarinet.
For the solo, yeah. I presume you're talking
about.
Oh, yeah,
sorry. I didn't... Yeah, the peculiar... Yeah,
you don't just like naming just, adjusted instruments.
No, just the peculiar solo, which I think is... I say peculiar in a good way. Like, it's different. It's interesting.
I think... I don't know, but I think it's a cor anglais...
Okay.
So I think it's two cor anglais duetting for the solo,
right?
Which is a very strange thing to suddenly break out of the sound.
Yeah, it is.
It just suddenly comes out because I don't think the cor anglais is particularly featured in many pop songs or folk songs, particularly being quite a unique sound within the orchestra.
Mm.
And So why do we call French horns in English, but we call cor anglais, which means English horn, cor anglais in French?
What's that about? Have
you ever noticed?
You could get a tight 20 minutes out of that, couldn't you, Paul?
I probably could.
Have you noticed?
Going out really well in the Philharmonic. So I think it's cor anglais doing that. So, yeah, okay. Some strange reedy woodwind solo in the middle of this thing.
It's strange. It is strange. The other thing that gets me with this, though, which is why I can't quite decide whether I like it or not, is it feels like the theme tune to a melancholy 70s British sitcom. I don't want to see you again. It just feels like...
Oh, yeah. I know what you mean.
It feels like something that would come on a Sunday, and you wouldn't massively laugh at it, but you wouldn't switch it off either.
It'd be about the tribulations of a young couple who keep falling out.
And... there'd be a montage of black and white postcards for the intro of them in different places around Liverpool or somewhere. And this would be the...
It's like a more grimy Live of Birds.
Yeah.
Something.
I could easily hear this as a kind of like just a gentle sitcom.
Yeah. No, I know what you mean. Actually, I can go for that. Yeah.
Which doesn't necessarily make for the kind of thing I'm going to listen to in my spare time, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
But I'm going to be 46 for music because there's nothing particularly wrong with it, but I just don't think it's strong.
No.
Production, though. So apparently I've been listening to the 2002 mono remaster, which has got some issues.
You reckon?
I think the drummer is way too loud in certain places than the song is calling for. And I say the drummer, the drums.
Yeah.
There's a bit where they suddenly like it goes a bit harsh and really loud, like animals kind of got into the studio. I quite like the little string run sounds, the little zips.
Yeah, I do too. I think they're quite good. They're sort of pretty subtle, and they do add to the backing. Given that we've got a duo here, basically playing acoustic guitars.
Yeah.
That's how we perceive them to be doing stuff. So it's got to have some sort of accompaniment, some sort of arrangement, some sort of band. And actually, they've done quite well with the string parts. It's Jeff Love again, who I mentioned did the accompaniment to this, and. Yeah, I think, like I say, I think the arrangement's nice, but there's just that sudden burst of cor anglais is just...
It's a bit strange, but it is interesting.
It is.
Yeah, obviously, you know, you never know how cor anglais is going to go down and whether it's going to make an impact on the world of rock and pop music till someone puts one out, I guess, and it doesn't. But so here we have possibly the beginning and end of the rock cor anglais.
Yeah.
But it's... I think I quite like it because it's different. I just find the drums a bit harsh in places, and I think the strings when they get into the legato are really nice as well. So actually, I've scored it 69 for production because
there's some good tambourine on it actually. So unlike a Beatles record, there's quite a lot of tambourine on this song, but it's very subtle in the mix.
Yeah,
so which is, it's used to enhance that B section where it gets faster, but it's still there along some of the other bits as well.
I found recently recording some tambourine and mixing some tambourine that you can't get it low enough, really.
No, it's tricky. Well,
it has to be.
I don't know if I talked about this when we've talked about it in the main first series where we talked about tambourines. But when you record tambourines, you have the issue of, you know, you've got to get all your mic placement right, right type of microphones, right type of position. You've got to play the tambourine well.
Yeah.
It's difficult to record a good tambourine. And then when you're mixing it, you've got to do stuff. So you've got to take out a lot of the low end. So you're reducing that thwack noise and just try to get the shaker noise sound of it. But you also don't want to take out too much so it becomes brittle and weird. It's a fine art.
It's a fine art. So
they've done well on this one. So Norman Newell, assuming it's him that's directed this session, is done well.
Well done, Norman. So we'll go on to the lyrics then. We've got a fair... subject for a song, being dumped. It suits the general tone. The line about turning your back. In fact, you know what? That would make the theme of the sitcom. It would have to be about a couple who were going through... you know what? They'd be friends still, but they were a couple. That's what it
is. Oh, yeah, that's it. That's it,
and,
yeah.
But they're still... Everyone knows that they, you know...
That they should be together.
But they'd be one of those couples that just frustratingly can never get on the same page about anything. The line about turning your back on me and hiding the light of day is a nice metaphorical aspect to it. That's quite nice, that line, I think.
But, yeah, if we think back, though, again, please lock me away and don't allow the day.
Yeah.
Yeah, he's not moved on much further, has he? He's like... oh, my girlfriend's brother needs a song again.
True, but by putting it in the framework of by turning your back and it blocking the light of day, it just takes on a slightly higher significance as the idea of someone turning away from you, you know, a breakup, blocking the light of day, i.e. happiness, etc. You don't need me to spell it out. Also, the not having to play at being brokenhearted. I quite like that because sometimes with the kind of lyrics they do write, at these they were writing, have been writing since they were 15. I think there is an aspect of playing at being brokenhearted because there always is when you...
Yeah, teenage love, isn't it?
Yeah, and this is...
So, this is a bit more mature.
Yeah, absolutely, that's it. So, I like that. And he's saying, yeah, I really am actually brokenhearted. It's because you dumped me. You dumped me. So
I'm not clowning. I'm not clowning around. This is real.
I'm not just doing it so I can look cool going, yeah, I've been dumped. It's like, you've actually dumped me. So, they're okay. I'm still only going to give them 52, but that's a slight, you know, improvement on some of them. So it gives it 55.7 overall. And again, Paul, no Beatles version.
No. I mean, would you like to hear a Beatles version? Can you imagine one in your mind?
Not at all.
No, I can't really for this
one. No, because it's a sitcom theme tune. I don't want the Beatles to sing a sitcom theme tune. They've never done it. Right. I'm trying to think if there's ever been a sitcom.
Well, there's been sitcoms that have used Beatles songs.
Yeah.
And we will cover something adjacent to this in a couple of episodes' time. There's a little teaser.
Oh, that's good. Oh, I like that. I'm liking the strange sitcom sideline. In fact, if anyone is listening, I'm thinking of someone like a Tim Worthington character who's listening and can think of what the sitcom is that's probably making me think of this. There must be some model that I'm basing this on in my head.
Yeah, I don't think it's necessarily a 60s one, but I think you've thought of something from the 80s and you've retrofitted it to be a 60s sitcom with this as a theme tune.
Yeah, I said more 70s. But yeah, something that we'd have seen in the 80s that would have been
probably
made
with Paul Nicholas in or something like that.
Yeah.
Tim would be a good idea for suggestions.
Yes.
For what you might be thinking of.
Anyone, just throw them at us on Twitter. And because this comes out a couple of weeks after we record it, we'll be going, what's this? Oh, yeah. Why is everyone tweeting the sitcoms? Anyway, let's go on to our last song for this week, which should be a bit familiar to people. That Means a Lot. PJ Proby.
Friend says that your love won't mean a lot, and you knew that your love is all you got. At times things are so fine, and at times
that means a lot. Paul, insert new joke here.
Yeah, well, I can't be bothered to make up a new joke if I even did one for when we talked about That Means a Lot in the anthology episode. I mean, we'll say this song is a lot. Recorded on date unknown, produced by Ron Richards for the Liberty label, but arranged and conducted by George Martin.
Okay.
So that's interesting. He didn't produce it. His colleague Ron Richards produced it. But this is arranged and conducted by George Martin, who appears to have been taken over by some sort of mad orchestra alien. We'll come to that.
I think maybe he wasn't producing it. He thought, I can just let loose.
Yeah, I'm going to go crazy. Yeah. I'm not even going to wear a tie. It's, you know, he would have worn a tie. It comes out on the 17th of September 1965 on Liberty Records, which for EMI. Spends 6 weeks in the chart and peaks at number 30 in the official charts, as they have been historically done. So this is not a big hit,
no,
but it is a hit. No, yeah. Not, you know, it's a top 50 hit. And we've got a lot to get through with PJ Proby, who is a newcomer to this run of songs. You know, we've got a few names doing a few different Lennon McCartney songs, but PJ Proby is legendary for a variety of reasons.
Okay.
Do you know anything about PJ Proby?
I don't, Paul, other than the fact that he's done this song and that you didn't want to tell me about him in the last one because we knew we'd be doing it in this one.
Yeah. All right, I'll do the potted history of PJ Proby. So PJ Proby is still with us. Okay. I think he's just into his 80s now. He was born James Marcus Smith. He was American. Mm-hmm. He started very early in showbiz and he sort of doing recording and doing movies under the name Jet Powers, which is a fantastic name. Jet with two T's, Jet Powers. But he comes to London in the early 60s under the sort of guidance of Jack Good, who was a TV producer of a lot of shows that had sort of showbiz pop stuff on them. And he was on the Beatles Around the Beatles special in 1964, which is another one of these bits of Beatles film that's quite legendary and would be lovely to have as a proper release somewhere. So that, yeah, there's a, you can watch Paul McCartney introducing him and he's, Paul does the most, oh, it's god awful, this link. It's like, all he has to do is say, this guy is, you know, all he has to say is, well, the next person performing is PJ Proby, a good friend of ours. Give him a round of applause. Mm. And he manages to mess it up. Really? It's like, and the next, and you look at his face and you look at the others looking at him and they're like, you've never met PJ Proby, have you? It's just, you're saying he's a good friend and stuff.
He didn't practice it, obviously, as much as John practiced his next act, is, ladies and gentlemen, the Rolling Stones.
Yeah, not quite. He wasn't doing it for like days at a time. But yeah, PJ Proby, very powerful performer. And so he was legendary for sort of these really sort of, the word raunchy is used a lot.
Okay.
Which is a tricky one when you're thinking of like someone trying to launch a pop career in 60s UK, early 60s UK, early mid 60s. But he was very popular, you know, he was American, he had a really powerful voice and used to do these very powerful performances on stage. But the sad thing for PJ Proby is that his legend was completely tarnished in the mid-60s, in 1965, because his trousers split on stage.
Oh, God.
And it basically got him banned from TV, from like all the theatres in the country.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to laugh because he's...
Well, no, because it is funny.
It's ridiculous.
Looking back, it's very funny.
He got him banned because his trousers split on stage. I take it he didn't intend for his trousers to split on stage.
Well, he used to do this thing. He used to slide on his knees, you know, like a kid at a wedding. Because he was very animated in his show, and apparently it happened several times. So.
Oh, right, okay.
So his trousers had split. But yeah, he ends up getting banned from all these UK theatres, so all his tours end up being cancelled. He gets some... His TV shows start to get cancelled. He has fewer and fewer opportunities to perform. He starts wearing a boiler suit to prove that he wasn't doing it on purpose.
Right.
And he believes, PJ Proby believes, that it was Mary Whitehouse and the sort of, you know, those decency campaigners went after him. So Daily Mail, 1st of February 1965, Proby show stopped. The curtain was lowered on a performance by American pop singer PJ Proby at the Ritz Cinema, Luton, last night after his trousers split. More than 1,000 teenagers in the audience were told they could have their money back.
It's mad, isn't it?
It's actually mad.
Split. Wasn't like, what, there was a little split in his kind of rear, well, and you could see
the implication seems to be that everything was on show, but I'm pretty sure it wasn't. You know, you might have seen some of his pants, maybe. I don't know.
What was he? I mean, it's a different thing if his trousers split all the way down his crotch and underneath it.
If his trousers flew off into the crowd and his pants followed them.
Oh, no, my trousers have split, he says.
Again.
Yeah. I mean, maybe. I don't want to say because
then,
this person.
Anyway, 2nd of February 1965, PJ Proby band. Mm-hmm. American pop singer PJ Proby, whose trousers split and fell down during his act at Luton. I'm sorry, because he could listen to this. He's still around.
Yeah, PJ, I mean, if you are listening, then...
But yeah, basically the thing I knew about him was Mum telling me, oh, PJ Proby, you know, years and years ago, it was like, oh yeah, he was the one whose trousers split and he got banned. It's like...
That's
what happened to his legacy. It's mad.
He went to
the ABC Cinema in Northampton last night to appear in a show, but was refused admission. Oh. It's... You know, and something else from the 2nd of February 1965. Proby, whose real name is James Smith, was barred from ABC theatres after his trousers split during his Sunday night show in Luton, Bedfordshire. Saturday, his trousers had also split during a Saturday night show at Walthamstow and on Friday night at Croydon. It was not a publicity stunt, Proby insisted yesterday. When I had the suits made, I just hadn't allowed for the way I move on stage. Nothing obscene or indecent happened. So, but yeah, it just dogs his career.
You would have thought, though, by the third time in a row, if he's wearing the same kind of suits that he's like, oh,
You might something about this.
I might not.
Can you pop down the... Yeah.
Go and get me some jeans, or I won't slide around on my knees.
Yeah. So he gets a few more appearances and singles in the 60s, and then, quite interestingly, in 1977, he sort of having vanished off the scene, it's certainly in the UK, he appears on Opportunity Knocks, the TV show, as the Masked Singer.
Okay.
Like the show, The Masked Singer.
Right.
So he sort of, his reappearances as this sort of like, well, we've got to hide this guy because people will remember PJ Proby. He had really long hair as well. He sort of, you know, had it in a ponytail. He was sort of, you can understand why decency campaigners would have gone after him. He was notably, you know, more of a performer.
Right.
In the, but he has a very troubled career and, you know, he sort of gets through several marriages. He has alcoholism, which leads to illness before he gets sober. He has stuff going on with guns and benefits fraud and all sorts of stuff. And I think even only a couple of years ago, he was talking about his marriage to girls who were, you know, legal to marry, but very young. And that was like, suddenly people were, you know, not booking him for shows in 2019.
I mean, PJ.
So it's he's had a very complicated life. But if you watch any of the footage of him performing,
yeah,
he's incredible.
Okay.
He's incredible. But then we come to this song.
Yeah.
And how we have to... Yeah. Okay. Let's get on with it.
Okay.
I've stopped, yeah.
Well, very interesting. I wasn't expecting that at all. So this song musically then, it's got a similar feeling in places to From a Window, actually, because it's got that dum 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 kind of feel again.
Yes,
the root,
it does, yeah.
The downbeat, the melodrama. But the singing on it is a little more kind of end of the pier, club singery, a bit showbiz.
Do you know what? PJ Proby was an amazing, it probably is still an amazing singer. Mm. And I'd never take that away from him. This record does not do him justice, no. I don't think.
It's all,
even the start of this, he's out of tune at times in it. And
yeah, and it's the way that, you know, it's those kind of...
unappealing sort of pronunciation of certain words.
Yeah, and the affected style of the kind of like a lot. You know, it's all a bit...
Yeah.
Hey, yeah. The song itself, though, has interesting touches, and the melody and the chords are great. As I'm sure I probably said when we looked at the Beatles version, I hope I did for consistency, but I remember thinking that the Beatles had written something that had got away from them a little bit, and it needed to be big, and it wasn't something that would suit them big, and I can see why they've tried to go that way with this, because I think the song has some merit. This version coalesces the sections better into one whole, I think, than the Beatles anthology version.
It's very different.
It's very different. It's closer to what this song probably required, but still not there.
Mm.
I'm not sure what it is that the song and what this style is. It's overblown. It's big and brash, and it's strange. Yeah. Still, it's not. It's an oddity, isn't it?
It's like a musical number.
Yeah, it is.
You know,
yeah.
it's like a huge musicals orchestral backing number. It's got this weird sort of oriental sound on it. I don't like using that word oriental. But like the pentatonic thing.
Yeah.
Over everything. And this is, you know, George Martin, like we talked about with the Yellow Submarine soundtrack stuff.
Oh, yes,
I love the way George Martin writes for orchestras. I love the way he writes, he scores and he balances things. Mm. That is not this George Martin. This is like I say, it's been replaced by an alien.
An alien.
An alien has got him. And
yeah,
it's just bonkers.
But it's interesting though. It is interesting to have that kind of ding, 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 ding all the way through. It's a very off-putting, eerie kind of thing to be there. And then suddenly to have like a big timpani coming in to kind of, and then big swells of the whole orchestra and it. It is strange. Yeah. But this version in this little chart for the covers is getting 57 for music. But please don't go back and compare that to whatever I said for the anthology version, because you'll only get disappointed with my inconsistency. I can't remember what I said for that. But where it's... I think it's got interest. I think it has. It's just...
Well, it's certainly interesting.
Yeah. And there's some... good stuff, but I just still think, I don't know if there would ever be a right version of this song, but yeah, anyway. Production, though, I don't like the production on this, because it doesn't manage the size of its... It's bitten off more than it can chew, I think. It does not manage the size of the arrangement and orchestration suitably at the top end. So the quiet bits are loud and the loud bits are distorted.
Yeah, it doesn't. It's just too much.
It's too much.
Over the top, bloody hell, George.
Yeah, but George,
very unlike him.
George doesn't produce it, though, does he?
No, but he does. He does the arrangement and he conducts it.
But maybe this is where you I could say.
And
unleashed.
He knew Ron Richards. So Ron Richards, who did the production on this, you know, he'd worked with George loads. Mm. They knew how to work together in presumably Abbey Road for this. And I don't know.
Yeah, it's strange.
You could do a ripping podcast series on this arrangement of this song alone if you were bothered. But
blimey. Yeah. I don't know. It needs some modern TLC or something. I don't know if that's part of the problem as well, that we're not hearing any remixed versions.
Yeah, if you're listening on Spotify, for instance, there's just two instances of this track on there, and they're exactly the same mix. Mm. And they're not... Again, I mentioned this, I think, last episode, about not all of these songs have the legacy treatment that the Beatles have. So Scylla, like we've talked about, has had some nice remasters done. Yeah. In the 21st century, and some of the other EMI artists have had collections put together. In fact, PJ Proby's had an EMI collection put together, but they've not spent any time revisiting and really remixing and remastering these things, which is what it would need.
And it comes down to also, even if you did, if it wasn't a good session and it was recorded hot, it wouldn't. There's only so much you can do.
There's only so much you can do.
You can't do anything if it was recorded distorted, for example. That's what they've got. They couldn't undistort a signal. They can they can mix it better if it was just badly mixed. But yeah, and like the Scylla one, which has had a bit of treatment, but also feels like
had a lighter touch in the first place.
Yeah, this is poor. So I'm only going to give it 40 for production.
Fair enough.
And then lyrics. I'm not going to really talk about the lyrics because we'll just be covering the same ground, won't we? So
the only thing I'd say is, oddly enough, so a friend says that a love is never true and you know that this could apply to you, whereas in the Beatles version it's this can't apply to you or don't apply to you, whatever it is.
Right.
Which is just, again, another weird swap of words.
That sounds more like, I want to say sibilance, but that's not right, is it? The way that, you know, if you're going to hold an ooh sound rather than an ah or a... They might have decided that's a better word to sing. But I'm going to give it the same as I did before. So I have looked back at the chart for that one just to see what I gave it, because there's no point covering old ground. If you want to hear us talk about the lyrics to this song and you for some reason have listened out of order, we talked about them when we covered the Beatles anthology version in episode something.
Episode 2 of the second series.
There we go, you see. So I'm going to give it 45 for lyrics, which gives it an overall of 47.3.
Right.
And, again, we do have a Beatles version, as well you know, because we've done a whole episode-y bit on it. So, a whole bit of an episode on it anyway. So we're not going to go over that again either here.
No.
No, it's too close to Christmas.
too close to Christmas for That Means a Lot.
Yes. So that's us for this week, Paul. That's all done.
Right.
So I'm going to just do the whole 15 songs that we've covered so far in this little mini chart.
Go for
it. I'm not going to... pull out just the top 10 because I think we can manage that.
Yeah.
So here we go. At number 15, Tip of My Tongue, Tommy Quickley. At number 14, Nobody I Know, Peter and Gordon. At number 13, One and One is Two, The Strangers with Mike Shannon. At number 12 from this week, That Means a Lot, PJ Proby. At number 11, I'll Keep You Satisfied, Billy J. Kramer with The Dakotas. At number 10, I'm In Love, The Foremost. At number 9, Hello Little Girl, The Foremost. At number 8, Like Dreamers Do, The Applejacks. At number 7, I Don't Want to See You Again, Peter and Gordon. And at number 6, From a Window, Billy J. Kramer with The Dakotas. Love of the Loved by Cilla Black at number 5. I'll Be on My Way by Billy J. Kramer with The Dakotas at number 4. Bad to Me by Billy J. Kramer with The Dakotas at number 3. A World Without Love by Peter and Gordon at number 2. And our new number 1, It's For You by Cilla Black.
Well, I never.
Did you not expect that, Paul?
I did not expect that, no, not at all.
I didn't expect it because I didn't know it existed until we did it. And
yeah, well, there you go.
I think it's the most musically interesting one of the lot so far.
Righto. But we're in this exercise is about.
Yeah. We're in quite a narrow band of scores here because I think there's a bit of a grouping of them that are all like there's not much between them, but that one's a bit of a standout, I think.
Fair enough.
Great. Well, thanks again, and this will be our last opportunity to wish you all a happy Christmas, because we'll be back next week as normal, all being well, after Christmas. So I'm going to wish you all a happy Christmas. As is Paul.
Crimbo!
Goodbye.